Hello, and welcome to the Electric and Eclectic Podcast Show with Roger Atkins and some truly smart and amazingly interesting guests.
After graduating, one week after handing in my MBA and that MA thesis, I boarded a plane with, it was $3,000 in an Apple computer, and just got on a plane and flew not to China, but to a place called Bangkok, Thailand. This was 1990. What keeps executives today up at night? So they say, oh, software-defined vehicle. That's a nightmare for me. I've been manufacturing pistons all my life. What's a software-defined vehicle? Oh, charging state for electric. No, I don't know too much about autonomous vehicle, ADAS. We got to figure out all these new technologies. And then lurking on the horizon is this, Godzilla of an industry that conceivably could do what to the auto industry, what China did to the solar panel industry. And that is completely overwhelm all markets with its lower cost products. And then you look around and say, why would we buy anything but Chinese cars?
Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
I hope you're going to enjoy this as much as I am, because this is turning the tables. I regularly listen. I listen avidly to Driving with Dunn, a podcast that brings together extraordinary insights from people in the automotive industry, in and around the automotive industry, from an individual I've come to admire who has spent so much of his life, I think a quarter of a century, in Asia. And given the influence of Asia now, not just China, on the automotive industry, coupling together that journey that Michael Dunn's been on in his career and life, together with the extraordinary guests that he's had. And you can look it up anytime on Driving with Dunn. It's all there as an amazing living library of conversation, insight, ideas that can help you understand and chart your way, chart your course if you're an industry manager, if you're there trying to shape the future of your particular part of the auto industry. So without any further ado, Michael Dunn, welcome to the Electric and Eclectic podcast.
Roger, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this opportunity to engage with you, the one and only Roger Atkins.
Well, you know, let's not have a love fest, but the feeling is absolutely mutual, I can assure you. You sent me some notes because, yes, I know who you are. And like I said, I've gotten to know you quite well, I think, by listening to your broadcast, your lovely podcast. But what I didn't really know was just how long you'd spent in Asia. Let me just read what you sent me. You know, China, Asia is my wheelhouse. 25 years across China, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Thailand. So can you give the listener a sense of how did you find yourself there? And give us just a kind of inkling of some of what that's about. I'll try and shut up for 10 minutes because I just want to listen to you. And then I'll pick up on some points that you reference about that journey. So, yeah, opening question. How come you found yourself in China for a quarter of a century, Asia for a quarter of a century?
So we go back to Detroit. I'm from Detroit originally. My dad was an automotive editor at Popular Mechanics. And his side job was to be a spy photographer. In fact, Jim Dunn is a legend, at least in Detroit, most of North America. He was the guy who would get the next generation Corvette or Mustang or Jaguar before anyone else would. And he would take these photos and sell them to magazines. They'd be splashed across it. What was my role as a teenager? I was the getaway car driver. So he'd have his long lens Nikon, you know, out the side window, trying to capture these cars with a zoom lens in an instant. Get it, you make several thousand dollars. Miss it, you go home empty-handed. So a lot of pressure on me as a teenager to go and get the job done as a driver. Don't go too fast, don't go too slow. So, but grew up around cars with him, got to test drive most every make and model. And he always encouraged me to say, wherever everyone else is going, make sure to go a different direction. So I took his advice to heart. And when I went to school at the University of Michigan, I studied Chinese intensively for 4 years. The class size was on average about three people. And the teachers were extremely demanding, tough as nails. You didn't dare walk into a classroom without knowing your Chinese. That really paid off. So that when I graduated, I looked around. Most of my friends were getting jobs at Ford, GM, and Chrysler. That's what you did. And so I had offers from all three companies, and I went to my dad and I said, which one looks good? And he said, none of the above. Go and do something completely different and radical. Go east. Go to Asia. You've been studying Chinese. Just go. Wow. And so after graduating, 1 week after handing in my MBA and MA thesis, I boarded a plane with, I remember, it was $3,000 and an Apple computer, and just got on a plane and flew, not to China, but to a place called Bangkok, Thailand. This was 1990.
Right.
Okay, so setting the scene a little bit. I had studied Thai, I had studied Chinese, I knew cars, and I had a sense that Asia was the future. Don't ask me, I don't know why, but just had this sort of intuitive sense that Asia was coming up.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
wow.
Okay, so we get into Bangkok, why Thailand, what happened there? Briefly, Thailand at the time was booming as an economy, and it welcomed foreign direct investment from automakers and suppliers. Most other Asian countries did not. So my first jobs were with Chrysler, Ford, and GM. Imagine they go to Thailand, they think, oh, different language, different culture, industry, competition, regulators. There's this guy from Detroit, and he speaks Thai, and he's here. Whoa.
Yeah.
So it was a nice fit. That was where things started in 1990. Yeah.
Wow. Look, I mean, that's a great illustration of not just listening to your dad. Your dad's a smart guy, clearly. I mean, and as you say, and many people listening to this will know, he is a legend. Absolutely. And I think language, that ability to learn a language doesn't come easily to most people, but it's about wanting to communicate with people, you know, from different cultures and yes, many other things. So it isn't just, I want to learn languages because I want to be clever or get, you know, this job or that job. It's a kind of a key to the door, isn't it? It's a key to the door of many other cultures, which clearly then you went on. So the 25 years we're talking about, were you out there for all that time, or did you come back in between for periods? What happened after Bangkok, Thailand then? How long were you there, and what happened on that first country?
Yeah, great question. So as life happens, Roger, I'm looking around as an entrepreneur trying to find business and traction, and people are asking me, who do you know here? No one. How long have you been here? 3 weeks. How big is your company? You want me around to the nearest one? Yeah, so it was rough going at the beginning, but I had checked in with Ford, GM, and Chrysler. I said, I'll be out in Asia if you need any help. And lo and behold, one day, out of the blue completely, I get a call from a manager, a senior manager executive at Beijing Jeep, up in Beijing, you know, 5-hour flight away.
Right.
And he said, urgent request. You said you can get stuff done here in Asia. Here's the deal. We agreed by contract to export Jeeps from China with our joint venture partner. We need to export Jeep Cherokees from China to somewhere. Keep in mind, this is 1991. Who's going to buy Jeeps out of China? Can you help us find customers for these Jeeps? Because if we don't sell the Jeeps and get some foreign currency, the joint venture partner is saying, we're going to stop production, no more sales in China. So it's the first instance of the Chinese using their leverage. And so I thought, oh my goodness. He said, our alternative is to put it on a ship and then dump it in the Pacific Ocean because we can't find a buyer.
Wow.
So by chance, I had a good friend named Kevin Whitcraft, trading company, American, based in Bangkok. He was doing a lot of work with the UN in Cambodia. He said, maybe I can make this happen. And I couldn't believe it, but he did. He convinced the UN forces in Cambodia to buy Jeeps, probably at rock bottom prices, from China. So that made me a hero with Chrysler at the time. My goodness, even though it was a small deal, but they were able to solve a problem. And that was a big lesson for me. Oh, just help companies solve problems and you'll be good to go. So That's a lead up to that took me back to China. Chrysler then said, we have bigger plans for China. Come on up here. So the company expanded from a Bangkok base to Shanghai and then to Beijing. And I moved up pretty much, yeah, the entire 25 years I was either in Thailand or Indonesia or China. I didn't go home. Yeah. Wow. Now, coming into the call, I wanted to share a very early experience in China that actually predates my graduation. As a graduate student, I went to China, to the southern city of Chongqing, China's World War II capital, as a grad student.
Yeah, yeah. It's very, very big these days.
Big. Big. 30 million people. Yeah. That most Americans at least would say, I've never heard of this city. But so I find myself at this university in Chongqing. And I want to tell this story because at this juncture we're at, Roger, with the Chinese automotive industry emerging as this like modern Godzilla that threatens to steamroll, overwhelm Western automakers. How do we begin to understand this place called China and how it works? Yeah. So way back in 1987, I find myself on a train traveling during Spring Festival from Chongqing to a southern province of Yunnan, where the sun shines all the time in the blue sky. So between those two provinces is Guizhou province, lots of mountains, and I'm on an old train with four Americans, and it's chugging along. Not like the maglev train that goes 300 miles an hour. This thing was going like 32 miles an hour. And in the middle of the night, the train suddenly lurches to a stop. It's pitch dark. We're in a very small station and nothing happens and we don't know what to do. And minutes go by, long minutes go by. Is this train stuck? Is it moving? What's going to happen? And so I see, oh, some Chinese passengers are leaving the train, but no one's really clear. And I said, hey, I'll handle this. You know, I speak Chinese. Watch this. I'll take care of it. I'll figure out what the hell's going on. So my three American friends stayed put on the train and I wander off onto the platform and I see one light with one window, and sure as hell at 3 a.m, here's this young woman in her late 20s minding the store.
Yeah.
And I got, oh boy, this is going to be terrific. I'm going to use my best Chinese and really blow her away. So in Chinese, I asked her, you know, could you give us an update on the train? Is it going to start moving again soon? Is a new train coming in? What can we expect? So she looked at me for long seconds and then she said, 不清楚. And I said, which means...
What's that? 不清楚.
不清楚. Not clear.
Okay.
I go, not clear. 不 means not. 清楚, clear. 不清楚. So then I rephrased my question. I said, what's not clear? The train schedule's not clear, or you're not clear, or my Chinese is not clear. Then she came back with the same answer. 不清楚, not clear. I asked again. She gave the same response. Not clear. Now, this served me so well, Roger, for the rest of my time in China, because things are never really clear in China. She may have not known. She may not have wanted to give me an answer. She may have said, here's a foreigner I don't want to deal with. But the default reality in China is that things are always ambiguous, unclear, gray, not black and white. And as Westerners, that drives us nuts. We want to understand, what exactly is this beast called China? How does it work? Lay it out for us.
Yeah,
and yet... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I'm interrupting, but I'm really intrigued by what you've just said and that kind of statement, because this is a 5,000-year-old civilization. Are you telling me and the listener that that's always been the way it is and it works perfectly fine?
Yes, exactly. So take, for example, the question on everybody's mind today is Taiwan. Even the Chinese don't, my best Chinese friends, they don't know. Everything is always up in the air and in flux. And that makes, you know, cultures like the Japanese or the Germans or many Americans feel very unsettled. Are they going to attack Taiwan or not? We frame it in that way. And they're like, well, there's lots of possibilities. And none of them are really clear until something happens. So what does that have to do with how we prepare for the Chinese? I think we have to sort of begin to see things from the Chinese mindset, because they're in the driver's seat. They're the largest manufacturer of cars, the largest exporter of cars. They dominate the EV industry, the battery industry. How do they think? What are their priorities? What are their values? How do they negotiate? How is it different from what we understand? I think that's going to be key to our ability to compete.
Yeah. Now, tell us a bit more about life living in China then, because you're going back there to the early 90s. Now, I've been out there, I don't know, not many, half a dozen times. And it was probably around 2014, I think I went out, first of all. And in between that first time I went and the most recent time, which was, it must have been about 2013. But then by 2019, so much had changed in that six years.
Yeah.
How much had it changed during the 90s? And I've got to tell you, Michael, I spent 10 years at the Volkswagen Group, that decade at the Volkswagen Group, in various roles working for Audi. And I thought my life was exciting and I was doing interesting things and being bold and brave. I now realize I was a lazy ass. I should have got on a plane and gone to China. I mean, man, seriously, this is so much to your credit that you've done this. But how did you get on living in China? Yeah. Like finding somewhere to live, you know,
right?
Getting paid, you know, all the basic things that we all do in life. I mean, how did that work?
Well, there's a reference, people talk about an expat package.
Yeah.
That means you're hired from the home country and sent over to China with glorious accommodations. You have beautiful home and a driver and a cook and a cleaner, and you don't have to worry about anything. You make a big chunk of money and you live in these gorgeous homes in suburban American, like suburban residential developments. And then you have me, who's kind of like, okay, I'm here trying to find my way. And out early days in the 1990s, what I could afford was what they called Chinese housing. Apartments in the city where all of my neighbors were Chinese, and I was staying in a place probably illegally because they didn't want, what's this Lao Wai, this foreigner doing, residing among the Chinese. So that's what I could afford in the early days, very much bootstrapping things. As I opened up offices and hired people, I just lived a Chinese life. Let's just say. So I'm grateful for that because I always felt like my feet are on the ground and I understood China in ways that maybe if you're coasting in and have a 2-year assignment in China and get out, you wouldn't be able to appreciate. So that's sort of how I got started. First customers was Beijing Jeep and then GM and Ford that came looking for partners. And how do they get into this most promising market? I think for our listeners, Roger, I kind of divide my time in China into two big chapters, let's just say. The 90s and the 2000s were an era when China decided that the way they were going to develop their auto industry is by forming joint ventures mm-hmm. with global automakers,
yep.
learn from those joint venture partners, and eventually be able to do it themselves. Not unlike, you know, the examples out of Japan and Korea previously.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very, very similar. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So one big difference was that I remember in 2009, I attended a conference in Beijing hosted by Minister Wang Gang, who's we now know as the...
Wow. He was the science minister then,
yes,
yeah?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. He's the godfather of China's EV industry. And that day at the conference, he gave a talk. Who else was there? Henrik Fisker was there. A guy named Daniel Sperling, who's a PhD professor at UC Davis, was there. Not a big conference, but in any case, Wang Gang had a message that day. He said, look, 25 years ago, we set out to form partnerships with global automakers in order that we could learn how to build an auto industry. Good news today, we've surpassed the United States. We're now the largest automaker in the world. Wow. fantastic. Bad news, as I look around the streets of Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, I don't see any Chinese brands. They're all Volkswagens and Buicks and Hyundais and Toyotas. Where the hell are the Chinese cars? And he said, there's only one thing we can do here. We will never catch up with the West on internal combustion engines. It's a game of forever catch. They're innovating. We're catching up. Yeah. We need to pivot to electrics. And we will make battery electric vehicles our own game, one in which we can lead in. That's 2009.
That's some meeting. That's some gathering. Just out of interest, was there a gentleman there called Professor C.C. Chan? Does he ring any bells?
That name is familiar. I don't remember that he spoke, but definitely I felt like, Roger, it wasn't a sense. You didn't have the sense that, oh, China's at a turning point. They figured this out. They're going to go electric and they're going to win. No, it was very much on the fringe. We're happy we're big, but we're frustrated that we're behind on the technology. So 2009, they sort of put that out there. Yeah. But nothing really happened. Yeah.
And what are you doing at that time then?
Yeah.
Mike, you mentioned various roles. What is your role at this time? How and why were you at that meeting?
Okay, great. So roll back the camera a little bit. I had founded a company called Automotive Resources Asia. We're advising automakers, suppliers, and investors on how to enter and compete in China and other Asian car markets. Okay. So your conventional consultancy business development. How do we get into this market and sell our products to this massive potential market? So our clients were automakers, suppliers, and investors. Nice. Eventually, in the mid 2000s, I met J.D. Power, the founder of J.D. Power and Associates.
Wow. Dave
Power. Yeah. And we struck, we became fast friends immediately. Felt like I knew him forever. And he said, we have ambitions to enter this market. You have great network. You have relationship with the consumer. Let's merge our companies. And we'd like you to run JD Power in China. So that happened around 2006. And during that time as managing director of JD Power, I would visit all of the Chinese manufacturers because they were interested. How do we improve our quality and customer satisfaction? It's in that role that I was invited to this exclusive meeting with the minister to try to shape where to from here for the industry.
Yeah. Wow. And of course, perhaps the listener doesn't know, but he had been, who we're talking about here, a senior manager or certainly a manager of some repute at Audi in Germany.
He did. Yes, yeah. He was.
So, and how then does, for example, that play in your mind for how people perceive China about, well, they just copy stuff. They look at what we do, copy what we do, that's it. There's no original thought. There's no kind of anything like this, because this is beginning to sound absolutely like original thought. Let's not just iterate internal combustion engines anymore. And we're on Euro 3, and they're all on Euro 4 and we're just chasing along here. The leapfrog thing is a huge thing of imagination. Nothing at all to do with copying. It's so from one man's imagination, how did this then spawn policy and much more of the momentum that we're now seeing the fruits of today? How would talk us through that 2009, 10, 11, 12 kind of period then, Mike?
Yes. So, to confirm, Wan Gang was trained in Germany, worked at Audi, highly respected. He was not a Communist Party member, but they recognized just his intellect and said, this is a guy we want to bank our future on. So
just stop on that for a moment, because I, if I'm really honest, don't really understand the difference. So what is the difference between a Communist Party member and someone else then? Because a lot of people in the West probably think everyone's a Communist Party member. But what's the distinction then?
I think the easiest way to understand it, again, trying to figure out this place called China, Wuqingzhu, not clear. is that the party leads everything. So one day, for example, I was at a meeting with the president of J.D. Power at the time, had come to visit, and we're sitting across from the president of First Auto Works and a party member. Party member keeps a low profile, but is very powerful. They control things. They shape outcomes. So we're at this lunch, and I said, hey, by the way, across the table, Mr. President, Mr. Party member, this, I'd like to introduce you to the president for J.D. Power. It's for, you know, he's a big shot back in the United States. And the two guys kind of looked at me like their ex-wife just showed up. Like, why are you bothering us with, he has some title. He's a conventional businessman. There's lots of those. I'm a party member. I'm a member of the party. So the party members are the source of power in China. And most people who are accomplished in China sooner or later do join the party, not so much because they're believers in communism, but they're members of the club, an elite club of leaders with influence. Here's a guy saying, I don't need that. I don't need that extra label. I'm happy as a scientist and an intellectual. So for people who don't join the party would say, well, what's the problem here? Why aren't you a member of the party? So he was strong enough to hold his own and say, I don't need that extra layer. I'll just be a regular guy. So the important point is to understand very rare in China to have this kind of thing happen.
Right.
At this high level of power. So, but back to your question, how did it shape policy? This is where we get back to the not clear. For the next 5 years, Roger, China started to put in this important policy where they said, all right, you joint venture partners who've been benefiting enormously from the access to our China market, we now mandate that you must set up parallel joint ventures that are devoted exclusively to designing, developing, manufacturing electric vehicles. And guess what? In those new joint ventures, all intellectual property introduced to those joint ventures immediately belongs to the Chinese partner. So this freaked out your Volkswagens and Toyotas and GMs. Wait a second. Yeah. We're going to instant trend. We can't license it. That's our intellectual property. So what happened? They talked to their Chinese partners and said, this doesn't look attractive to us. By the way, Chinese consumers don't want electric cars. By the way, the range is short. The expense is high. The batteries don't last. There's safety issues. Let's form these parallel joint ventures, but then just sit on it. We'll continue to bake your Buicks and Toyotas and Volkswagens. We as joint venture partners will be happy because we're making profits. We can appease the people in Beijing like Wang Gang, but we're not really going to go after electrics.
Wow.
You got it? You see? Yeah. It wasn't like, oh, top down, Wang Gang says a great idea. All forces moved in that direction. No, you got this sort of up in the air ambiguity. And for the next 5 years, Roger, if you look at the numbers, electric vehicle sales in China just kind of trickled along at very small numbers, like thousands of units a year. Okay. Now, so how do we get to where we are today? Next date, very important date, 2014, August, Xi Jinping, chairman, Communist Party, in charge, takes his top lieutenants to a seaside resort in August of 2014, and there they begin the work of this blueprint called Made in China 2025.
Neat, yes.
Which you've heard of, yeah?
I have indeed heard of. I know it quite well, but not as well as you, I'm sure.
So he's there and he's saying, well, there's only one way to really get this done. We as a nation want to lead in next generation technologies, electrics, autonomous, AI, semiconductors. How are we going to do that? We are going to be not only suggesting or recommending, but we are going to mandate and put billions of dollars behind this effort to invest in batteries, battery supply chains, electrification, charging stations, the grid. It's real. We're going to put huge money behind it, plus incentives for people to buy cars, plus incentives for people to manufacture cars. And that was another pivotal moment, 2014, when this blueprint comes out. says this is the ambition. By 2025, we want to be global leaders in these technologies. Yeah.
Right. Mike, now here's the bit that I'm starting to not get confused about, but just don't understand. So that wasn't some kind of sinister plot to take over the world. It was an industrial strategy that was put into the public domain. I vaguely recall at the time various countries around the world saying, well, oh, hang on a second, where does this sit with World Trade Organization arrangements?
You're right.
Does this sit with, you know, this, that, and the other, a few other things. But essentially what it was, and, you know, I'm trying to be non-partisan. I'm British. I'm a European. I'm a citizen of the world. I'm not pro or anti-China. But nonetheless, what strikes me about this is a government, a responsible government, taking a long-term industrial strategy, 10 years, 2025, you know, made in China 2025 from that late 2014, 2015 place, and say, how are we going to help build our country? What do we think are going to be the key technologies and the things to make it happen? How will we have a supply chain? How will we help our industries? Well, tell me if I'm wrong here, but isn't that what government's supposed to do in any country? Isn't it?
It absolutely is. They had a vision. They committed to it. They put the money behind it. Where it gets a little bit delicate or sensitive is how much money are they putting into it, and what kind of cost advantage?
Yeah.
How much money are they putting in? Like, so they'll support this thing in such a way that, yeah, they can dump their cars all over the world at very low cost. Then you say, hey, great policy, but now you're killing our industry. So hold on. And this is what the EU is looking at right now with their anti-subsidy probe. So no problem with the policy. It's ambitious. Any country would do the same. It's just that when it comes to the point today where China's exporting 5 million cars globally and rolling into markets like we haven't seen before, people start to say, hey, how come your costs are 30% lower than ours? Is that innovation, or is what's scale, or is there something else going on? Yeah.
Yeah, well, we both know what it is, don't we? I mean, please tell the listener, because, you know, here's the thing. Again, I think I know, but I know you know. So how is it that they can do this and make very impressive vehicles now at a price that we can't get close to?
Mm-hmm. Part of it is scale. And then you take, not all Chinese companies are the same. So let's take the leader out of China. That's BYD, hands down the most powerful automaker out of China today. They delivered 3 million cars last year. They'll probably deliver 5 million by 2026. Mm-hmm. What's their secret superpower? So number one is years of vertical integration. BYD, first and foremost, a battery manufacturer that's evolved into a formidable car maker. They have for years been not only building batteries, but also the cells, and also doing the processing, and have interest in the mines. So they're controlling their cost, their supply chain from the mine all the way to the manufacturer of the battery, to the design of the battery, and then into the car. So that's a huge, like Tesla.
I was going to say, we know someone else is doing that. Yeah,
yes. Tesla. So that would be the number one differentiator. The second one would be, BYD is notorious in China for being extremely tough on costs. So when they do go outside to suppliers, they beat them up. Like, suppliers tell me, we long for the days of Volkswagen or GM or Nissan. We haven't seen this kind of brutal.
The irony. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's number two. They're really tough on costs. And number three, to be candid, there's no question that BYD has secured benefits from the local and national governments in the form of incentives, land leases that are, you know, discounted, energy for their factories that are discounted, all kinds of imaginative ways to set up BYD for success. So the puzzle for us here in the West is, How do we separate those out? Because the Chinese will say all day long, no, we're just more competitive than you guys. You guys aren't working hard enough. You're not smart enough. And we say, is that really the whole picture, or is there other things going on? And this is where we come back to trying to unravel what exactly is going on in China. What's their cost advantage, and how much of it through innovation and scale, and how much of it is because there's this like all of nation effort to make BYD and other automakers successful?
Wow. Yeah. Listen, like I say, I was at the Volkswagen Group for 10 years, and I did some other stuff. But a moment I just want to briefly allude to was late 2010, I worked at MODEC, which was a little startup electric van company. We used LFP batteries. We sold a handful of vehicles to FedEx and UPS and a company called Tesco and some others. It was an extraordinary adventure. It was my first taste and, you know, sense of proper engineering and manufacturing, because it was a small factory and all of this stuff. Anyway, cut a long story short, we're a couple of years into the recession, the global economic, you know, meltdown. Everyone was in it. And we weren't in a good way, like probably everybody else. Nonetheless, we'd been invited. The company had been invited to go and meet the Chinese ambassador, Madame Fu Ying. And without going into all the details, no one else was going to go. So I volunteered and I said, I'd love to go. I'd love to meet, you know, Madame Ambassador. So I did. And no word of a lie, this is what happened. I tried out some of my Chinese, by the way. I only knew a few things, and I just thought out of courtesy, I should be able to say my name. So I said, Washer Roger Atkins. And yes. Then I said, you know, this is going to sound bad to you. But then I said, what was it? Why Ying Ying Bai or Lai Birmingham? Because it was a meeting in Birmingham. And then when we were doing the lineup with the ambassador, introducing ourselves, I was the only one trying to do some Chinese. And then Madam Ambassador said, oh, Mr. Atkins, you speak Chinese. Anything else? So I said, I hope I get this right. Hao hao xie xie tian tian shan shan. And she said, oh, you're quoting Mao. I said, yeah. I said, because through education comes progress. That sounds like, you know, wisdom. That sounds like a smart thing for someone to say.
Yes.
So anyway, we got on well. We had the dinner. Some other things happened.
Hey, Roger, I bet she's smiling and her shoulders are relaxed and said, here's a guy who took time to think about the world as I see it and to communicate with me in my own language.
Well, it went more than that. Yeah, thank you for that, Michael, because I think she did. But then I explained my wife had worked in the Foreign Office on the Hong Kong agreement in the mid-1980s. And then she explained to me she'd been one of several translators for Deng Xiaoping. And when I said, yeah, I kind of, I know that journey. I know the story of the 18 farmers. And she looked at me and she said, you know the story of the 18 farmers? I said, yes. She said, Mr. Atkins, in my role as an ambassador, I have met two other Westerners who know that story and about that moment. So I said, okay, well, no, I just looked it up. I thought it was out of courtesy. I know you're a person of significance. I just wanted to make sure, you know, if we did talk like this, we can have an interesting conversation. Here's then where the really interesting bit. She said, this is late 2010, Mr. Atkins, why don't you bring your company MODEC to China? We have grand ambition and big plans for what we call new energy vehicles.
Yes.
We could help a company like yours, and you know, we could do things together. I'm sure life is difficult for you. It is for many companies around the world. We know that. But we would like to help you. So anyway, I hot-foot it back to the company and explain all this. But sadly, then the thought is, well, what do we want to go to China for? They're just going to copy what we do. And of course, they would have done that. But they would have also, and you know this, Mike, they probably would have worked closely with us. We would have been given courtesy and respect. And somewhere along the line, the guy that put all the money into MODEC, he would have got all his money back and some. Mm-hmm. And okay, that we would have survived in that fashion. And who knows what would have happened. But sadly, and I think it was it's an illustration to me at the time of the cultural lack of awareness of what China is as a nation. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a pity. But there you are. So let's come right back to where we are now. You've alluded to various things that are happening, this lack of a level playing field. We can't suddenly find the 10 years that we've lost, if you like, so to speak, that Made in China 2025 period. We can't snap our fingers and have all these supply chains suddenly emerge. I'm going to ask you a big question now, Mike. What should we do?
First and foremost, and this is going to be an unpopular opinion, but just realistically, we need to put in place tariffs for 3 to 5 years to buy ourselves time.
Okay.
Without those, look, the Chinese, why are they exporting like crazy right now? Part of this story is their domestic market economy has slowed dramatically. They're sitting on massive capacity, overcapacity, upwards of 15 million units of overcapacity. There's enormous pressure on all of these automakers to go out and find new markets and find profits.
Right.
So they're not sort of thinking, oh, it'd be nice to also sell abroad. They're thinking, this is our lifeline. We need global. Okay. So they're full steam ahead. And we on our side in the West are totally unprepared. How do we match their prices? We can't. Nobody can. So short term, unpopular opinion, no one likes tariffs, but I would put in place tariffs and say, we have 3 years to sort of race to get more competitive. The second thing I would do would be what the Chinese themselves did and then said, if you want to come in and get our market access, then we're going to ask you to set up electric vehicle joint ventures with us.
Right.
I know it's odd and awkward, but it's right from the Chinese playbook. And we could learn a lot by sort of sharing in the, you get market access, but we get to learn more quickly by partnering with you. That's an option.
That's very much an echo of a previous guest I've had, Bill Russo, his turn of phrase was, I'm sure you know Bill, flip the script.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's right. But didn't your former president, I'm wary of politics now, but didn't your former president basically put in the tariff situation to stop the Chinese export onslaught, if you like? We haven't done that in Europe and some other places, albeit that BYD buses, I think, sell in considerable number in the United States. We have to be careful with politics, I know. So we're recording this at the end of January in 2024. If come the elections in the United States in November, the next president and administration, let's just say TBA to TBC, either carries on with those tariffs or maybe even makes them harsher, harder, more. Are you kind of sensing that's where we're going to go? Is that going to happen? And should we now do this in Europe then? Is that what you're saying, Mike?
Yes and yes. I think the United States, regardless of who wins the next presidential election, I'm confident based on my conversation with people in D.C. that those tariffs will be where they are or higher, not lower. So that's U.S. And then China looks at the world and says, well, like water, let's find the path of least resistance.
Right.
Wow, Europe looks attractive. In particular, Europe, well, wait a second, there's some countries in Europe that don't have homegrown auto industry. Spain, Sweden, you know, arguably Sweden, UK, you know, those are the areas. They'd have a tougher time in Germany, France, and Italy, but they definitely are targeting Europe first for the reasons you mentioned, because the tariffs aren't there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your point's well made. I mean, I'm not going to go through the exact number because I can't remember what it is, but essentially more than half of the European member states have got nothing to do with the auto industry directly. They don't manufacture. Some of them have got tier ones and suppliers in them. For sure they have, but nonetheless, they're not there. But, and I don't want this to sound too emotive, but the tentacles of Chinese enterprise are already all over the place. You know, you're seeing battery factories being built in Hungary. You're seeing, you know, all sorts. Well, Geely is a case in point of an extraordinary way in which, and I'm a big admirer of Lee Shufu, because I think the way he's managed companies like Volvo, essentially left them alone, really, just said, do what you're best at and we'll help you. But you got to do a good job. You got to show up. You got to work hard.
Look at his track record. Volvo, Polestar, Lotus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So how do we put the genie back in the bottle, I suppose, Mike, is one way of looking at it.
I'm not sure we can, Roger. I'm not sure we can. Like, you know, it's enough. What keeps executives today up at night? So they say, oh, software-defined vehicle. That's a nightmare for me. I've been manufacturing pistons all my life. What's a software-defined vehicle? Oh, charging state for electric. No, I don't know too much. Autonomous vehicle, ADAS. We got to figure out all these new technologies. And then lurking on the horizon is this, Godzilla of an industry that conceivably could do what to the auto industry, what China did to the solar panel industry. And that is completely overwhelm all markets with its lower cost products. And then you look around and say, why would we buy anything but Chinese cars? I don't know how we put the genie back in the bottle. I really don't.
Right. Another thought, you kindly shared that journey. Amazing journey, quarter of a century, going out there as a young man, bold and brave, not doing the traditional thing of the expat life and whatever. Huge admirer of your approach to that. Really get into the culture, be in the country, be one of them. I think that's massively to your personal credit. But the other side of your life and your journey, and I mentioned at the beginning, the podcast, you've spoken to an extraordinary array of people from all around the world. How does it all shake down in your mind then around what we're doing and where we are? And what do you do with that other than you've got this amazing living library of conversations with people? How can that get tapped into, if you like? I don't want to use the word exploited, but how would you see both yourself and others using that? Because I think it's so useful hearing all the voices that you talk to.
Here's something I did learn along the way in China. There's a lot to learn from Asian cultures, including Chinese cultures. Early on, I remember my friends in China saying, we have a saying in Chinese that says, you can always learn at least one thing new from somebody else. Whether you like them or not, your kindred souls or not, there's something to learn from another individual. So at first I thought, well, that's kind of naive to say. What are you sure? Maybe not. But as time went on, I began to appreciate, every individual professional is focused on something and often deeply focused on it and knows stuff that the rest of us don't know. So when I have a podcast conversation, I really look forward to try to unearth what is that secret superpower or knowledge that person has? What can I learn that's new and different? So that's one big motivation for having the conversations. The second one is, it's sort of a reality check on where we are as an industry globally. And my big takeaway after 126, 27 episodes now is that we are genuinely in the midst of a revolution, as you've said many times, Roger.
Yeah.
And like the Chinese with their bu qing shu, they're unclear, not clear. I feel like people are still searching and finding and trying to figure it out. Rare do I have a guest on that says, I nailed it. I know exactly what's next. And I can see the future. A lot of it is tentative and searching. And that, in a way, is reassuring to me. Okay, yeah, we're all having a narrative, but that narrative may shift because we're genuinely at the frontier of things. We're exploring, we're uncovering, we're discovering. And that's helpful to me professionally to stay grounded and say, where are we? To bring it back to a specific example, let's take autonomous vehicles. One of my guests, Riley Brennan, on the podcast, great guy out of San Francisco, runs a VC called Trucks. He said, look, how quickly do things change? Summer last year, Cruise was at the top of its game, special rights from the state of California. valuation was like, is it $100 billion? What's the valuation? And then only a few months later, everything came crashing down. Yeah. So what's the takeaway there? Nobody has it figured out. Everyone's still chipping away. And so that's, I think, enormously beneficial to me and to my clients who are investors and automation suppliers. When I talk to them, I say, hey, don't spend too much time looking left and right. Just keep focusing on innovating for your own business, because nobody out there really has the secrets. You're not missing a memo that would put you on the right track.
Yeah. And the other thing I genuinely like how you do it is when you do, you know, you have a nice intro and you have a nice outro. And when you have that outro, you kindly summarize, you know, the salient points out of it for people, which of course most of us have, we think we've done a bit of that ourselves anyway, but then it nicely just reorientates you at that moment. So I really do enjoy the way that you shape it and deliver it. But look, one of the questions I asked, I mentioned Bill Russo. You do know Bill, don't you? I'm sure you do.
Of course. Yeah, Bill. Yeah.
100%. Yeah, I didn't take it for granted. But, and it sort of works around some of what we've talked about. Do we need to collaborate more with China than just have this confrontation? And I don't just mean that's what tariffs are, because I don't think they are necessarily. I think they're part of business and, you know, they are tricky and clumsy, people can argue. But given that the advancement of mankind now is predicated on tackling climate change, mm-hmm. and that the twin imperatives of electric vehicles, you could argue, are both tackling air quality, which was a big one in China back in the day, still is, and around the world, and indeed reducing CO2. How do we avoid kind of almost like seeing climate change, all these challenges fall in the gap between what Asia is trying to do and what the rest of the world is trying to do? And I suppose we especially keep talking about China. But how do we avoid the law of what's it called, unintended consequences? That in this kind of geopolitical, you know, tectonic plate shift, this epoch moment for the auto industry, that we don't lose a lot of stuff down the back of the armchair that we really can't afford to lose.
I love your imagery of the tectonic plates, because it really speaks to the realities between the United States and the West and China. In a way, there's an asymmetry going on here, Roger, where in developed West, we want to, oh God, we have a great thing going on here and we want to preserve this. And climate is number one for us, for many people. It's just don't destroy the planet. Asia, China included, is still building their economies and their incomes. And they say, yes, climate's important to us, but so is income and growth and GDP. And oh, by the way, Communist Party, I need to keep growing the economy to stay in power. So there's an asymmetry there. The priorities are not the same. They're not the same. Let's just be honest. So nobody's fault, no judgment. It's just different. So that's one. Second thing is, I feel as though the West, in particular the United States, did make a mistake of putting virtually all of their eggs in the China basket in the 1990s and 2000. Not China's fault, but sort of got lazy intellectually and said, well, everyone else is going into China, we should go in there too. And to the neglect of the rest of Asia. And I see a way forward in the next 10 to 20 years where the West reorients itself and begins to distribute its investments in places not called China. We're already seeing that with Apple and others going into Vietnam, into India. Keep in mind, Southeast Asia, 600 million people. India, more than 1 billion people. With investment and infrastructure, those economies will be the ones that blossom in the next 10 years, I believe. And even the Chinese companies are racing into Southeast Asia. So I see a sort of a reset. Let's not just have it bipolar US-China zero-sum game. As the West, let's engage more of Asia and spread out our bets so we're not so heavily dependent on China. You know, we got ourselves into this position of becoming overly dependent on China, then we would blame China. Oh my God, you guys are locked up all of our supply chains. Well, who did this?
Yeah. And so, indeed, you know, you could argue Wall Street exported a lot of the jobs out of America.
Absolutely.
For the bottom line of shareholders. You know, they didn't come and steal a bunch of jobs in the middle of the night.
No.
You know, that's the irony. We've kind of done, your point here is we've done this to ourselves. But you also mentioned there a few big things around numbers, population. As I understand it now, for the first time in a long while, China is not the most populous nation on earth. It's India. And we see the growth of, I think, the top 30 countries in the world with population growth, because lots of them are in decline, of course. Mm-hmm. Birth rate, etc. Of the top 30 countries, 26 of them or 25 of them are in Africa. Mm. So when we look at, if you like, the structural shift in the human population, the demographics, the aging population in the West and countries like Japan and so on and so forth, I guess that sits underneath as an undercurrent around a lot of this policy shift and a lot of this ebb and flow of what technology are you doing, why are you doing it, how are you trying to develop your economy. Mm. You know, I guess that sits underneath it all as well. Would you agree, or am I imagining that and making it up in my mind, in my own head?
Absolutely. From one perspective, you know, China has very grave demographic issues. They're going to get old in a hurry, many people say, before they get rich. So that's a little bit panicky for the leadership in China. How do we fight this gravity called demographic change? Two, China's economy has slowed dramatically. And at the same time, let's be honest, Western companies are less welcome than they were before. Whether it's the auto industry or other industries, there's definitely a nationalistic thread there, a sentiment. More and more Chinese customers are buying Chinese. So these are all incentives for inventive and forward-looking Western companies to say, hey, that was a great run in China. Let's look at the frontier. And to me, the frontier would be places like Indonesia, fourth largest population in the world, Vietnam, India, Thailand, and then, as you mentioned, Africa. So let's use our imagination to say that was a phenomenal run in China. It's probably flattening. It'll still be a very important market, but in terms of growth opportunities, the West needs to probably look elsewhere, in addition to the all-important thing about national security and supply chains. So I don't think that we can anticipate that the U.S. and China are going to kiss and make up anytime soon. I think the relationship what's the old Bob Seger song? I know you love music. There's that song called... what's the name? You'll know the title, but I used her, she used me, neither one cared. We were getting our share. Night moves.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I step back and reflect on the U.S.-China relationship, commercial relationship in the last 25 years, it's like they were getting theirs and we were getting ours, and it was good for a while. Maybe it's time to move to the next chapter.
Well, moving to the next chapter, concluding this conversation, which I've loved and I hope our listeners love too. You mentioned my love of music. Well, I think just listen to the lyrics, read the lyrics of The Times They Are Changing, Bob Dylan. I think one of the lines in it is, today, you know, the person today that's last will tomorrow be first. You know, there's that switch around, switcheroony kind of thing.
Yes.
Which is that's what life is. Nothing good or nothing bad lasts forever. We are all in a constant state of flux, if you like. And I think if you see the world in that way, your life in that way, your own life, don't take anything for granted. Don't give up. Always be positive and reflective, and be the young Michael Dunn and strike forth and go out to those places and see what happens. So look, Michael, we could talk about so many other things, but I think we've had an hour or so, maybe just under. But thank you so much for your invaluable time. I'm 100% positive the listener now really knows you. And if they haven't already, if you haven't already and you're listening to this, please listen to Driving with Dunn. You'll be enriched with it. There is so much there. Go back into the library, as well as just picking up the regular ones when they come out. So any final thoughts, Mike, before we go?
I'd like to have a prediction from you.
Oh, Okay. Yes. My prediction is that the electric vehicle revolution isn't the big one. The big one is going to be autonomous vehicles. And that ownership of vehicles will be a thing of the past sometime over the next decade or two, maybe even sooner than we think. And I say that because the most inefficient part of a motor car isn't anything to do with the mechanics, electronics, or anything else. It's the utilization of this incredible asset. So my prediction is mass adoption of electric vehicles will never happen because it doesn't need to, because something else is coming.
Phenomenal. Okay, I love that. Can I ask for a second prediction?
Who's going to win the U.S.? I want one from you. Come on.
Presidential election. Who's going to be the next U.S. president? I love to ask people who aren't American this question.
Okay, well, look, from what we see over here, unless he has to go to prison or anything like that, it's going to be Donald Trump, without a shadow of a doubt. And again, without lifting the lid, you know, and the whole can of worms of all of that, much of what Donald Trump, no, let me rephrase that. Some of what Donald Trump said and did has been proven right. And I think it's far too simplistic to just say, oh, he's not very, you know, he's clumsy. He's like, he's like a bull in a china shop, all these sort of things. Personally speaking, I don't like him. But he's not the idiot some people portray him to be. He absolutely is not. And I think people who just see the world too much like that, you know, they're just, everything about him is wrong. That's just foolish. You know, maybe most of about him is wrong, but some of what he's done and said and who he is and the people that he surrounds him with, his party, they're right on many things, you know. So that's my observation from over here.
From afar. Yeah. I totally agree. For example, just a couple examples. One on China, he was the first president to say, hang on, wait a second. What is the nature of our relationship with China? Who's benefiting and who's losing? No, we don't want to do this anymore. And I'm going to put tariffs on. And everybody goes, oh, tariffs are terrible. No one loves tariffs, but he was sending a message. Enough is enough. We don't want to do this anymore. And had he not put the tariffs on Chinese cars at that time, which was, well, what's the tariff on Chinese? There's no Chinese cars coming in anyway. No, no, it was very, very prescient.
Yeah, foresight. Yeah,
He saw the risks. So I agree with you. In many ways, his personality and his personal behavior is way out of bounds. But on the other hand, you know, China, he's been very good. And on other things like the border, I live in California here, it's almost ridiculous. The border situation, where just thousands of people coming across the border every, what is going on? And then they're being shipped from Texas up to Chicago and Boston. It's a circus. What nation would have such porous borders?
That's another can of worms. It really is. Probably best not go there on this one.
Yeah, no.
Mike, thanks again. I look forward to the next Driving With Done podcast. Just listen to the one about the lovely car, the fella up in Sweden you were talking to, up in Stockholm. So that's great. And thanks again. And I hope to meet up with you soon sometime, maybe in China, maybe in the States, wherever. But for now, Michael Dunn, Driving With Dunn Ledge. You're a legend, my friend. Thank you. And good evening.
Roger, thank you so much for having me. Let's do this again soon.
Thanks for listening to the show. And make sure you follow Roger on LinkedIn, where you'll discover almost all there is to know about the spectacular electric vehicle revolution.